Drill one. Where do you come from, Mr. Sherwood?
I was born in Southport in Lancashire.
Which year was this?
1918.
What did your father do for a living?
He was with the Commercial Union Assurance Company.
Doing what precisely?
Well, he started off as a junior in their Manchester branch around about the early 1900s, and was then transferred as a junior official, as they called him, to their Dublin branch around about 1907, I think. And after service with them, and on the outbreak of the First War, he joined the Royal Dublin Fusiliers and served with them in Gallipoli. He came back from there, took a commission, and was appointed to the South Persia Rifles that I mentioned to you earlier, and served with them until the end of the war and demobilization, when he returned to Dublin early in 1919, in the middle of the Anglo-Irish War, with his new wife and one-year-old son, me.
What was your education?
I was entirely at grammar schools. First of all, at what was then called Kingstown Grammar School, outside Dublin, most of my years. And I had 1 year at Macclesfield Grammar School here in Cheshire, now called the King's School. I left school at 16.
To do what?
To join a company, Henry Simon Limited, engineering company, a flour milling engineering company at Stockport, also Cheshire, as a junior. Euphemistic term for office boy, a jack of all trades, running messages, collecting mail, making cups of tea for my seniors and so on and so forth, and at the same time being trained by that company with a view to becoming, to joining their technical staff on the flour milling engineering side. This didn't involve studying engineering, but it did involve 4 years of study of flour milling technology, leading to a City and Guilds of London Institute, what do they call it, diploma? Or something like that, before one could be considered for further employment by the company. There was also training in flour mills in Stockport and back in Dublin. And by that time, the Second War was about to break out. And that was the end of that part of my career.
How did you react when you heard that we were at war with Germany? Were you dismayed?
No. We were a very young generation then, looking back. Reasonably well informed with what was going on. Listening largely to our seniors' comments, parents, mothers and fathers, and what was going to happen, the likelihood of war. Politically very immature, at least I certainly was, and lots of my contemporaries were then. So that we were aware that war was likely to break out, and more aware that it was going to break out, and very excited when it did, brought up on stories of adventure and so forth in the First War, none of which conveyed any of the horror of war. And when you're young, as I'm sure you know, you're inclined to be adventurous, you look for adventure and excitement, without ever stopping to think that it may lead you into a very unpleasant end yourself if you're not very careful.
What was your attitude towards the German regime?
One of dislike for what it stood for and the extremism that it represented, which was quite, even in our immaturity, a threat to the way of life that we were accustomed to.
How did you come to be in the services?
Well, when the war broke out, I was actually still in Dublin, training in this flour mill there. And about 2 or 3 weeks later, I decided I should be a volunteer, not one of the wisest decisions to have taken, really, far better to await the ones called up.
Why was that?
Well, this may sound a bit daft, but I'll say it. I was brought up as a boy on the basis of a volunteer being worth two conscripts, if that doesn't sound terribly old-fashioned. This was the way my father spoke, and I presume that he spoke like that out of his experience in the First War. So on the basis of that, I thought I must volunteer because I did better than the conscripts. wait for them to be called up, only to find, of course, as anybody with more intelligence could probably have told me, that once you're in the services, they don't care who what you are, and it doesn't make any difference to your status or the way you're treated or anything else. They're not interested. You're in the services, and that's all they want. So that was the first lesson in life, really, never to volunteer. But by then it was too late. I didn't regret it anyway. But round about mid-September of 39, I decided that I should I was interested in joining the Air Force, really. And without weighing up any pros and cons or discussing the subject with anybody, and not with my parents either, who were living over here anyway, I decided to chuck in the training and just turn up in Manchester at home and just join the Air Force like that, possibly with the feeling that they were waiting for me to come along. When I went along to see the Air Force, the first thing they wanted to do was give me an eye test, on which I immediately failed. I couldn't see. My eyesight's reasonably good. And I don't know what the technical description for the sort of eyesight I've got is, but whatever it is, it's opposite way to the way most people are, and the Air Force didn't like that. So bang went my chances of getting into the RAF. I rejected there and then out of hand. So I then decided to try and get into the Navy. But the Navy weren't recruiting anybody at that time. And they said, well, you'll have to go away and wait until we send for you. And indicated that that could be months. Well, I chucked up the job, the training job I had in the mill in Dublin. And there was no going back, really. So at the bottom of the list was the Army. And when I went along to see them, they said, well, we're not recruiting either. But he said, are you a driver? And it so happened I was. And he said, well, we can probably recruit you as a staff car driver and send you over to France, in a very airy sort of casual way. And I thought that sounded absolutely marvellous. I fancied myself driving big staff cars around France, a la First War style, old converted Rolls Royces and so on. And I need hardly tell you, but having said yes to that, and accepted the King's shilling, or two bob, I think it was then, I was promptly shot down to Aldershot, attached to a motor transport company, put through a brief training in the handling of motor lorries, and never saw a staff car from that moment onwards, never ever, except from the outside, with other people driving it. In other words, I drove lorries for the first 12 months of the war, with the Royal Army Service Corps, which I was posted to, and became a dispatch rider on motorcycles at the time of the Battle of Britain, scuttering around Kent with messages and this sort of thing, preparatory to going over to France. Before our unit could be transferred to France, the army was all coming back again from through Dunkirk, so we didn't get to France. We stayed in Kent, a station not very far from Ashford. And very quickly all of us bored stiff, because the atmosphere then was a bit, it wasn't depressing. There was no fall of morale, but there was boredom, because there was nothing to be done. And just sort of repetitious training, and going out on endless map reading exercises on motorcycles and so on, which was great fun at first, became boring, because it was pointless. You know, we were reasonably good at it by that time. We didn't see any point in carrying on. And just when we reached the stage of wondering what else we could do, a small handful of us there, we heard, and I can't remember how we heard of it, but of volunteer units called commandos, which were being formed, with the object of crossing the channel in fast motor launches, grabbing a German or two if possible, bringing them back for questioning, and creating any mayhem possible on the coast of France, coming back again, and then waiting for the next time. And soon after that, an army lieutenant came round, who eventually discovered through meeting him again was Roger Courtney, who formed the SBS, but Roger Courtney didn't mean anything to me at that time. And he came round recruiting for the commandos, and four of us applied for interviews with him, much to the disapproval of our own CO. The COs didn't want to have their men pinched by these units that hardly anybody knew very much about, but didn't oppose it. But we were unpopular because of it. And after being interviewed, which I suppose was probably around about July of 1940, absolutely nothing happened then. We thought, well, this is the end of that try to get out. And there were various other things we volunteered for, machine gunners on trawlers in the North Sea and so on and so forth, without being accepted, sadly, or perhaps just as well as things turned out. Until one day in September, we were called into the orderly room and said, you're off, here's your rail pass to Windsor, get yourselves together, and you go on the so-and-so train from Ashford.
You'd had some kind of interview with Courtney.
We'd been interviewed by Courtney earlier, around about July.
What type of things did he appear to be looking for, from judging from the interview?
He wanted to know, could we swim? Did we have any knowledge of demolitions? Had we any knowledge of boat handling? Those were the main questions he asked, apart from having a look at us to assess our, I suppose, our likely ability or suitability for this kind of work. My own knowledge of demolitions that time was a picture I carried in my mind of a workman with a pickaxe standing on top of a brick building, knocking lumps out, demolishing a wall. I never thought of demolition in terms of explosive. So having said yes to the question on demolition, which was accepted without any further question by Courtney, I think his questions are perhaps tongue-in-cheek. He was an adventurous man himself, and I think if he saw some spark of adventure in the chap he was interviewing, that was enough. The rest really didn't matter. And the fact that perhaps we couldn't swim and didn't know how to blow anything up or know anything about boat handling didn't really matter, because we would be trained in that. I think he was looking for some spirit that suited him. He'd incidentally, and it's worth mentioning this at this stage, had done all kinds of adventurous things in his own life. I think I'm right in saying that he started off as a junior in one of the banks in London. And this was too dull for his likings. So he took off, went out to Kenya to seek his fortune there, with no knowledge of the country and no knowledge of anything else except what he'd been taught in the bank, but a love of adventure. And this was the sort of man he was. And he had various jobs with farmers around Kenya, none of them paying very well, as the books he wrote on the subject indicated. And then he went in for big game hunting, taking parties of rich Americans out into the bush and shooting lions and elephants with an abandon which nowadays, of course, wouldn't be tolerated. He also had a spell in the Palestine police. And probably more interesting still, he'd canoed almost the entire length of the White Nile from Lake Victoria to Egypt in a two-seater foal boat. A thing which he called the Buttercup, for some reason or other, and as far as my memory serves, which was to surface later on in our own careers.
How did his personality come across when you met him? Or as you got to know him?
A very tough sort of man, very self-reliant, full of a love of adventure, rather like a grown-up boy than anything else. Tremendously confident, confidence-inspiring, and very likable as a person. Not a blustering, swaggering sort of pistol stuck in his belt type of bloke, but a straightforward man with an adventurous spirit which he wanted to put to full use. We liked him and would have been prepared to go with him there and then. He was that sort of chap, full of enthusiasm for these raiding parties. Aggressive spirit against the Germans, and especially after the collapse of in France, something was needed to sort of inspire people. And he clearly saw himself as the sort of man who could inspire that sort of love of adventure and crossing the Channel and so forth.
So I interrupted your narrative with you going off to join the unit.
Yes, we went to Windsor and were accommodated in the Horse Guards barracks there, Combermere barracks, from recollection, and found that a troop, number 8 troop, as it turned out to be, was being formed there by a man named Godfrey Nicholson, a captain, who I think had been an MP before the war, but I didn't know much more else about him. But more interestingly still, Randolph Churchill, Winston's son, and that's where we encountered him for the first time, and he was forming this troop. Don't ask me if I can remember what a commando troop consisted of, because I'm blowed if I can now. 40 or 50 men or something like that, perhaps. And as soon as formed up at Windsor, we were then to be transferred up to Scotland to become part of number 8 commando, 8 troop of 8 commando, which at that time, and I'm talking now of around about October 1940, was based at Inverary in Argyllshire.
What did you do there?
We were thrown in at the deep end. This was in the days before the Commando Basic Training Centre at Achnacarry Castle at Spion Bridge was formed. So each commando set about training according to its own ideas on training. And the basic idea at that stage for the newcomer was to weed out those who could stand the pace from those who couldn't. So within 24 hours of arriving there, the next day, we were formed up, complete with all our gear, full pack, rifle, respirators, all our tin hats, the rest of the paraphernalia, and headed by Randolph Churchill, who looked to us to be very fat and unfit, but who proved himself as capable of taking anything that he had to take as we were. What we could do, he could certainly do. But I remember the perspiration poured off him. He must have lost about a stone on this, what turned out to be a speed march, which was high-speed marching, stopping short of running. And I think the aim was to do something like 7 miles in an hour, which was, with all the gear, was quite some going, especially for some of us from units like my own, the Royal Army Service Corps, had been sitting behind vehicles or on motorcycles for most of our war up till then, with a bit of drill and PT and that sort of stuff. And we belted out along the road northwards by the lake, the lock, with Randolph at the head, going hell for leather for about an hour out. After a brief stop, about 10 minutes at the end of that hour, we turned round and did the same thing coming back. And it was the return journey that weeded out those who could take it or made themselves take it from those who couldn't. And those who couldn't just fell out on the roadside. No disciplinary action was taken against them. It was a volunteer force after all, and they were trying to live up to that. But they were returned to unit the next day and were never seen again. Now, before this march took place, nobody was told the object of it. It was only afterwards it dawned on us what the object was, to weed out those who'd stick it. And it was absolute agony. Could you imagine your thigh muscles at the end of that? We were just about doubled up. We were just about managed to hobble in back to the camp at Inverary Randolph still there, still pouring buckets of sweat. And as we got nearer to the camp, the pace broke up, so the line of blokes were sort of going up and down like this with everybody out of step. And Randolph, I can remember at the head, shouting back, "Pick up the step!" And a lot of rebellious spirits in the sand saying, "You know, bugger off with this sort of thing." And making no effort to pick up the step at all. And he made no further effort to say anything more about it. And when we got back to the camp, we were fallen out, and so, right, you've got the rest of the day off. And we needed it, because I don't think any of us could have managed to hobble another few hundred yards after that. Now, that was the first day we were there, and those who stayed the course carried on with the training then after that. And this was all kinds of basic training, really, with full pack and full equipment, doubling up and down hills, through trees, tangling up in undergrowth, everything at full pace, everything to build up your fitness and losing weight rapidly and becoming fitter and fitter every day. Instruction in the use of, in a very mild way, of explosives, small explosive charges. We were never allowed ourselves to handle this stuff. We always had to watch other people doing this, which annoyed us a bit, because we wanted to get our hands on this and try our own arts and sort of blowing things or people up. Grenade throwing, ordinary range work with rifles, 303 rifles, Tommy gun practice in a very limited way. They never seemed to have an enormous amount of ammunition to throw around. I don't know whether that was so or not, but there never seemed to be enough going where you could go on doing this forever. Everybody was given a sort of rather short burst of training, and that was that. I suppose we'd been doing this for about a couple of weeks, or two or three weeks. And the whole commando was uplifted from its camp at Inverary, stuck on board a commando assault ship named the Glengyle, HMS Glengyle, and sailed round down the loch, round into the Clyde, lay off Gourock, where we were offloaded, and sent down by buses to Largs on the Ayrshire coast as a complete commando to carry out further training there and to have our first experience of living in civilian billets. The idea of the commandos, and you've probably heard this before, is that you were given an allowance, I think it was about 8 shillings a day over your ordinary pay, and then you were told, go and find a civilian family who will put you up. That was the theory of it. In fact, with a move like that, somebody went on ahead to do the recce, interviewing local civilian families who would be prepared to take in the soldiers for 8 bob a day, plus a ration card, which was particularly attractive to the civilians, you can imagine. I think service rations were a rather higher level than civilian rations. So that when we got there, we found we were all allocated in threes and fours to houses dotted all around Largs. It was a nice little seaside town, who'd never had any services there before. It was their first experience of any of the services. And they turned somersaults for us there. They couldn't do enough. The hospitality of the local Scots was something to see. And the families on whom we were billeted looked after us as though we were their own family. They were really tremendous. So at the end of a hard day's training, or hard night's exercises on compass marches and this kind of thing, simulated attacks, etc., etc., we could return to a comfortable billet where we'd be well fed. And the old things who used to look after us, there are lots of mothers with their own sons grown up and elsewhere in the service. You can imagine what they did for us. Masses of food, cosseted and pampered and comfortable beds and so forth. It was a great time there, very interesting. I can't remember how long we were in Largs, possibly 3 weeks to a month. At the time it all seemed much longer, you know, but looking up sort of details, there were really short periods in any of these places. We were told we were leaving Largs and transferring to Arran Island on the other side of the Clyde. My voice is going out. the whole commando was being transferred to Aran Island, and the impression we were given was that we were preparing to be sent on operation, an assault somewhere, as a complete commando. But nobody said where. It was all kept very quiet. When we got to... We sailed out of the Clyde again. And I think we were in a former cross-channel passenger ship named the Royal Scotsman, as far as I can remember. We anchored in Lamnash Bay on Arran. We were again put into civilian billets in the village of Lamnash. And within a day or two of arrival, were called out on parade by Godfrey Nicholson, Captain Nicholson, who was in charge of 8 Troop of 8 Commando, and told to our fury, because we couldn't see that we were responsible, it was our officers who were supposed to be training us, that our standard of training wasn't considered sufficiently high by the command of 8 Commando. And we were going to be disbanded, just like that. A disbandment meant only one thing, return to unit. And there was a really angry reaction to this, although we were on parade.
And openly.
A lot of very offensive language used, which under other circumstances would have been acted against. And I think I was quelled by one or two of the more experienced sergeants, you know, sort of just in effect cool it, although that wasn't in expression at that time. And our immediate concern was to avoid being RTU'd. I didn't want to go back to the RASC. We'd all joined to do something interesting and for adventure, and we weren't going to be just dumped like that. And I happened to hear through somebody else, one or two of the other rather disgruntled characters, that there was a small section known as the Falboat section being formed by a man named Roger Courtney, and that he was looking for recruits for this. So without further ado, about half a dozen of us applied for an interview with Roger Courtney. And when my turn came to see him, and he was based ashore, a hotel at Nash, I think, I recognized him as the chap who'd interviewed me back in Kent some months before. And discovered that he was looking for applicants for his Falboat section, as it was called then. It wasn't known as the SBS until some weeks later, really. that we discovered that this involved the handling of Falboat canoes. Well, this was strange to the other chaps who were with me, but not to me. Because it so happened that when I was training in Dublin in 1939, I had bought and owned a 2-seater Falboat canoe. So I knew what a Falboat was, and I knew something about canoeing. And what is more, I knew a fair bit about canoeing on open water, since where I was, on the Irish Sea. I canoed not on rivers, but on the sea, and in various conditions. So I was used to handling a canoe, used to rough sea conditions, and confident in the water. Although I was a lousy swimmer, I could hardly swim a stroke. But this didn't bother me at that stage. God knows why. It should have bothered other people. The last thing you want to do is to have anything to do with boats if you can't swim. However, that's the way it was. I'd also always been very keen on rock climbing, mountaineering, mountain walking.